From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll help you understand what's on your ballot for the spring election. We'll learn what it takes to put the Milwaukee Film Festival together.
I think a real challenge is that we may fall in love with a film and be like, this is perfect. The film distributor or the filmmaker, you know, has different plans. We hear no a lot.
Plus, we'll learn how purple vegetables are good for your garden and your health.
The color purple in a food normally indicates something that is high in antioxidants, produces a lot of vitamins and minerals.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Today is the spring election. Voters can cast a ballot in the presidential preference race. There's also two statewide ballot measures, and depending on what community you live in, a number of local elections. In Milwaukee, that includes for mayor, city attorney, and common council, as well as some other community-wide races. Ahead of this election, WUWM has been doing stories to help explain what these different positions do and what exactly the referendums you'll see on your ballot mean. To start, WUWM's Mayon Silver speaks with J.R. Ross from WisPolitics about how the presidential preference vote works here in Wisconsin.
The April 2nd election is not just the presidential primary. It's also a regular nonpartisan spring election with local offices on the ballot around the state. In southeast Wisconsin, there are elections for mayor, circuit court judges, city and county boards, school boards, etc. But I do want to focus for a moment on the presidential primary choices that will be on people's ballots. Can you explain how the primary works in our state?
Sure. So one, in Wisconsin, we have an open primary system. Which means you can vote either in the Democratic or Republican primary. You don't have to be registered as a partisan to do that. And then you'll have your choice within those fields of who you want to vote for. Now, the races are pretty much settled, right? Joe Biden and Donald Trump both secured enough delegates to win their party's nominations. What'll happen here is both political parties have a formula for how the vote turns out, the number of delegates that those people get. Then they go on the convention, Milwaukee and this summer for Republicans, Chicago this summer for Democrats. They'll be on the floor of the convention hall, and then comes a roll call for Wisconsin's votes. Somebody will announce that's X votes from Wisconsin for Joe Biden and Y for somebody else. And then the Republican one, you know, A for Donald Trump and B for somebody else. Then, you know, for the most part, there won't be a lot of drama because these guys have secured enough delegates to have the nominations. Now, if there were somebody in an election that didn't have enough delegates to secure the nomination, be an open convention, broker conventions call sometimes, and then it'd be a fight on the floor for who would win. Or if something happened to Joe Biden or Donald Trump between now and the summer, then you'd have a different situation. But for right now, it's pretty much a formality, except for a couple of things. One, Democrats had this option on the primary ballot called uninstructed. It's been there for a long time. We've seen similar options in other states where people unhappy with Joe Biden's foreign policies, especially the war between Israel and Hamas, have used that to express their discontent. That's something I'm watching to see, is there a big groundswell of support for that option, which would be a rebuke for Joe Biden. On the Republican side, you know, Nikki Haley dropped out of the race, but we keep seeing states where she gets a good chunk of the vote in the primary, which suggests that there are people who are hardcore Republicans who are not happy with Donald Trump as their nominee. So what's it look like in Wisconsin? Is there any like widespread discontent over Trump? That's something to watch. At least there's not a lot of drama for our primary in Wisconsin, but that's might be something interesting to watch.
And once a party has its presumptive nominee, which is what has happened with the Republicans and the Democrats now, what are the next steps when it comes to conventions? Obviously, Milwaukee will be hosting the Republican National Convention. Who are these delegates and what do they do?
They're party activists who are bound to a candidate. So let's just take the Democratic primary, for example. Joe Biden wins X percent of the vote in the primary April 2nd. He will get a number of delegates according to the formula the party has for that. They all go to Chicago, bound to vote for Joe Biden on the floor of the convention. Now, the uninstructed option, If it gets enough of a threshold, it crosses the threshold when delegates, they would go and they would be able to cast their votes the way they want to. It's a something to watch there. But it's kind of, these conventions have become glorified political commercials over the years. There used to be some drama years and years ago, but we've really, the race has been decided with these primaries, and there's not a whole lot there other than the parties try to put on a four-day show of unity, drive their message. They want to, you know, get to people about why they think they should be in the White House, those kinds of things. So it's kind of more of a pep rally for the base and a message vehicle for swing voters if they tune in. And let's be honest, how many people spend four nights in a row watching speeches hour after hours? Not a huge audience, but there are people who turn in, dorks like myself, and kind of pay attention to see what's going on.
That was J.R. Ross with WisPolitics speaking with WUWM's Mayon Silver about how the presidential preference vote works in Wisconsin. Now, let's look at the Milwaukee Common Council race. All 15 seats are up for election today. To learn what council members do, WUWM's Eddie Morales speaks with longtime alderman Michael Murphy.
Can you describe what responsibilities Common Council members have?
Sure. So the city of Milwaukee is approximately 600,000 people. We're broken down as a mayor common council form of government, and there are 15 members of the common council. Each member is representing approximately 40,000 people. They're nonpartisan, elected on a four-year term, coterminous with the mayor. And an alderman has really mainly two responsibilities. One serves as a legislator for making laws in the city of Milwaukee, and the other serves as an omnibusman in which they work with constituents to help solve city problems that their constituents may be having with city government.
If you could just describe what districts are up for election and what's at stake for those open seats.
Sure. So there's 15 seats that are open, but in terms of elections, a few of the races are competitive because some eight automatic races, there's no opposition. So the incumbent will be taking over that a seat again, unless some extraordinary circumstances arise. So there's seven competitive races, but there's two open seats. And that, what I mean by that is that the current incumbents are not seeking re-election. And that's the 10th district and then Alderman Borkowski's district, who is also not seeking re-election.
How does policymaking and passing legislation work?
So great question. So if a citizen, for example, has a thought or an idea about how to change and make a law, they contact their local alderperson or their mayor and say, and they make a suggestion. And they would like to know, is it legally possible to pass a law regulating, let's say, the restaurant industry? So what happens then is the local elected official will research that with the Legislative Reference Bureau. They'll check to see if there's any state statutes that may preclude it. Because the city of Milwaukee is its own local governance, it can make its own laws through resolutions, through ordinances, or through charter ordinances. It has to conform with state law, but we do have an ability to regulate local government. So we look at what legally is permissible. We then research to determine, the pros and cons of that legislation. We draft that legislation. And then as the president of the Common Council in collaboration with the city clerk will then direct that legislation to the appropriate one of seven standing committees the Milwaukee Common Council has. So we break legislative items up into standing committees in which that item is referred to. And each committee is comprised of five members appointed by the president of the Common Council. And they would take up that proposal, review it, have a public debate on it. They're always open to public meetings. And then the council committee could either hold it, they could pass it, or they could turn it down. Let's say they pass it, then it's referred to the full Common Council, which we meet on the third Tuesday of every month, with the exception of August, which we're out of session. And then they take that legislation up and they can either vote for it, they can hold it, refer it back to committee. But for this argument's sake, they can, let's say they pass it, is then referred to the mayor. And the mayor then can have the opportunity to vote for it and sign the legislation. Or not sign the legislation, it still becomes law, even if he doesn't sign it over past 10 days. But if he vetoes it, then it gets sent back to the Common Council at its next regularly scheduled meeting. And the Common Council can either sustain or override that with a vote of 10 votes, which is two-thirds of the Milwaukee Common Council.
Can you clarify any misconceptions about what people think the Common Council is responsible for?
Sure. I think most people, you know, realize the Common Council members have the authority over city government. And that involves city issues involving from the police to sanitation. But I think over time, people have come much understanding that that position is probably the closest to the citizen in terms of elective office. There's an old adage, you know, all politics is local, a book by Tip O'Neill, former Speaker of the House. And I think quite honestly, people in Congress or in the Senate or in the state legislature, and I'm not saying it's because of them or their activities, but because of, you know, whether it's COVID or other issues, they become more distant from the citizen. They feel that, you know, those issues, they really don't have an impact upon, for example, national policy or foreign policy, or even administrative actions involving their federal government they have. So the first person they generally call is their local office person, because they see them in the restaurants, they see them at the corner grocery store, and they know they're very accessible. So they contact the local office person, whether it's city, state, or federal issues, because they feel that they can really effectuate and have an impact in making changes. So I think that's a really positive thing about being an alderwoman on the city council, is because, quite honestly, I can make a difference. I can make a change within a couple hours or within a week. You can't always say that with federal or state officials.
That was WUWM's Eddie Morales speaking with Milwaukee Alderman Michael Murphy about what the Milwaukee Common Council does. There is a vote for both City of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County Comptroller. But what exactly does that position do? To help explain, Lake Effects expert Nunez speaks with outgoing City Comptroller Aicha Sava.
Can you describe some of the responsibilities you have as City Comptroller?
Sure. So the City Comptroller is kind of an odd role in local government. There are only, in the entire country, there are only about like a dozen or somewhere around there elected comptrollers. They are mostly like the CFO, finance director. They're mostly appointed positions by the mayor, generally. We are independently elected, so that means that the comptroller is the city's fiscal watchdog. They are kind of looking out for your taxpayer dollars. They are not beholden to the mayor. They are not beholden to the 15 alders, the council members. And they are just looking out for the best interest of the city's financial health. So under the comptroller, there are 8 divisions. So we have a lot of different responsibilities. I guess you could say the main easiest one to understand is we are the central accounting office of the whole city, and we are in charge of producing the city's annual financial statements, which is accompanied by the external audit, the financial auditors, and our financial statements, which is called the ACFR, is like 100, you know, it's like a huge thick booklet, like almost 200 pages of everything of the city. And then the other big division, the other largest division in the office too, is our grants division. So we do a lot of fiscal oversight of the grants that are administered through different departments of the city. So we get a lot of grants in different departments, like the health department, police department. But then we also pass through grant dollars to not-for-profits within the city so that they can, you know, do the good that they're doing. So we do a lot of monitoring on them. And then there is also a second component to that external audit I was referring to that audits the grant dollars and makes sure that they are utilized appropriately. And so our grants division within our office is kind of the head of all of that in the city. So those are like the two huge divisions. We are an office of about 50 people. So there's a lot more people than I think people think. We also run payroll for the entire city for over 6,000, 7,000 employees. So that's a pretty large undertaking, as well as, you know, filing all the correct tax reports and everything else that goes along with that to the IRS. And then we run the city's whole debt program, which is over $1 billion. And that's actually kind of more like a one-man job. We have a capital finance manager who does have someone who's working with him as well. And then we have internal audit, which is the division that I started in, that pretty much does internal audits, programmatic financial audits on all the mayoral departments, and kind of has an eye on polishing the city. So they are professionally, they follow professional standards and do IT, accounting, financial, programmatic audits. And they also run the city's fraud hotline. 50% of all fraud is found through employee tips and other tips. So that is a very important ethical component to kind of being that fiscal watchdog of the city. And then two more divisions. The other one is our financial services division. They do a lot of, we do the revenue estimates for the city. And now with the new city sales tax, we did the estimate of how much we think that the city is going to bring in with the new 2% sales tax. So we do all the revenue estimates. And then we do, when there are new tax incremental financing districts, we do an independent fiscal analysis. And there's actually a lot more that the division does, but those are some kind of easily explainable ones. And then last but not least is our systems division. They are kind of that cross between financial systems and being systems analysts. So they help with a lot of the fiscal reporting and kind of the systems aspect of the financials.
And some residents will have the option on their ballot to vote for city comptroller and county comptroller.
Correct.
How do these offices differ, or do they overlap or work together?
So I have a good relationship with the outgoing comptroller, Scott Mansky, as well. We do a lot of very similar things, very similar. The county is set up a teensy bit differently, but they are, for the most part, those large parts like the debt, the internal audit, the finance, the central accounting, those are all run out of their comptroller's office as well. So it is actually pretty similar. And actually, they used to not be an elected position up until 2012. So then they kind of modeled a lot of their things after the city's model.
That was Lake Effect's X Grit Nunez speaking with Milwaukee's comptroller, Aicha Sava, about what the position does. You'll see two constitutional amendments on the ballot. They both have to do with how elections are administered. The questions were added to the ballot by Republican lawmakers after the 2020 election. If voters approve them, they'll be added to the state's constitution and will not be subject to the governor's approval. WUWM's Lena Tran talks with Anthony Chergosky to learn about the referendums.
What are these questions doing on our ballots? What is a ballot measure?
Sure. So in Wisconsin, we have pretty limited forms of what is called direct democracy. Direct democracy refers to when voters vote directly on a policy item. Normally, in American government, we have our representatives vote on policies, and then the voters vote for those representatives and then have the chance to vote for re-election or to vote those representatives out of office. There are some forms at the state and local level of direct democracy where voters are asked on the ballot to directly approve or disapprove of a proposed measure. In Wisconsin, we have some forms of direct democracy at the local level. We see that most commonly with school funding measures. There's a big one in Milwaukee, and there are dozens of school funding measures around the state in the April election. At the state level, there is only one form of direct democracy, and that is a constitutional amendment. In order to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot, the state legislature needs to approve of that amendment in two consecutive sessions of the legislature. It is not subject to the veto of the governor, which makes it pretty appealing for Republicans who control both chambers of the state legislature. They can get something on the ballot without having to contend with the veto of Governor Evers. Of course, a lot of the Republican Party's policy agenda has been blocked by the veto pen of Governor Evers. So through the constitutional amendment, Republicans can get things on the ballot, get things in front of voters. And we've seen that several times over the past few years. And we see it again in the April election this year.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad you mentioned the veto thing. We'll definitely get into that later. There's two questions. Both are yes or no. What is the first question all about?
The first question deals with private funding for election administration. This stems from the 2020 election. A foundation affiliated with Mark Zuckerberg and his wife, Priscilla Chan, put money into election administration in a number of localities in Wisconsin. And that became a focus of the post-election controversy. Republicans referred to this money as Zuckerbucks, claiming that there was something improper about this money, that Mark Zuckerberg was up to something. I think it stems from distrust of Meta, the company that owns Facebook. It may stem from distrust of big tech. It may stem from the suspicion that Republicans generally have about the 2020 election. But for whatever reason, this money from Zuckerberg became a major topic of conversation, and Republicans are taking aim at that type of funding in this first ballot measure.
Mm-hmm. And so this question, the way that it's worded, it has a not in it. So lay this out for voters. A yes vote would mean what versus a no vote?
A yes vote on the first question would prohibit levels of government in Wisconsin from accepting these types of dollars from non-governmental agencies. In other words, a yes vote gets rid of this type of funding for a local election administration. It takes out of the question this type of funding being a factor in the type of resources that local governments might have.
Okay. And then the second question, also election related, this has to do with election officials. What is this question all about?
Yeah, this question is very related to the first question, I would say, because it's related to non-governmental resources being used in election administration. And this one is all about staffing. What you see is that the coalitions or the supporters behind issue one or ballot measure one and ballot measure two are basically the same here, because more generally, it really does relate to the staffing that is possible for election administration. The question here is, you know, who is qualified, who is allowed to administer elections? Is it only elections officials that may administer elections, those designated by law who may administer elections, or are we not going to have that in the Constitution?
And you mentioned the vetoes earlier, and this is a way for the Republican-led legislature to kind of circumvent the possibility of a veto by the governor.
That's exactly right. This cannot be used for every policy, the constitutional amendment route, but in this case, Governor Evers has not been on board with this proposal, so Republicans can use the constitutional amendment option to circumvent the Evers veto. Now, in the past, we have seen a number of constitutional amendments get proposed by Republicans and put on the ballot. Some of these have been higher profile than others. I would say that this particular constitutional amendment appeals more to the base of the Republican Party. Strategically, I understand what the Republicans are doing. Their base is very concerned about elections in general. There are all these conspiracy theories swirling about the 2020 election. There are certain conspiracy theories surrounding the funding from Mark Zuckerberg. There are some complaints that are more perhaps based in facts. But for any number of reasons, Republican voters seem fired up about this particular issue.
Anthony Chergosky is an assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. He spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran about the two constitutional amendment questions on the ballot in today's election. There's also a referendum about funding for Milwaukee public schools on the ballot. You can learn more about that referendum more about the statewide measures, and learn about the candidates you'll see on the ballot and much more in WUWM's online voter guide. Remember, you are allowed to look things up on your phone while you're in the voter booth. So if you come across something on your ballot and you have questions about it, head to WUWM.com to find our voter guide. In about 15 minutes, we'll talk about the color purple and how it can improve your garden. But first, we'll speak with Milwaukee Film's artistic director to learn what it takes to put a film festival together. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Starting on April 11th, the Milwaukee Film Festival is returning to local screens for its 16th year. It features 300 films from local, national, and international filmmakers that show off a wide array of topics and formats. With such a lineup comes a ton of work in order to prepare, choose, and make an entire festival program that gives viewers the opportunity to enjoy a film during the festival. Kara Ogburn is Milwaukee Film's artistic director, and her work in programming the festival is featured in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine. She joins me now to share more about what it takes to put a film festival together. Kara, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. Of course, anytime.
So on average, how far ahead are you and the other staff members at Milwaukee Film thinking about and starting this whole planning process for the annual film festival?
Yeah, so prior to 2018, you know, when we were predominantly a film festival, it would really be about 9 months. But now that we operate a cinema, you know, we're kind of always looking at films, whether that's for the cinema or the festivals. Films don't necessarily, you know, come to us pre-designated, this is a festival film, this is a cinema film. A lot depends on the timeline and the release calendar and things outside of our control. So you can really say kind of year round, you know, even overlapping. There are films that we saw maybe at this past January's Sundance Film Festival that maybe weren't quite available for us for this year's Milwaukee Film Festival, but they might be for next. So it's almost like an 18-month revolving cycle these days.
Yeah. So what steps are you always thinking of? You said like pre-2018, what would initial steps look like compared to now when you're constantly having it in the back of your mind?
I mean, I think it remains the same, right? The team is always kind of reviewing and logging other film festival lineups, noting films that feel appropriate. As an example, the San Francisco International Film Festival just announced their lineup. Their artistic director is a friend. And I said, what's this movie about otters? I'm very excited to see this otter movie after the festival and, you know, find it a home to come to Milwaukee. So we're always looking at other film festivals. Our submissions process, of course, sort of sits directly in front of the festival. Films get submitted to us starting in the summer and until, you know, late January, early February, depending on our dates. And those obviously come to us kind of in a batch. And are considered that way. But we're always kind of seeing what's appearing. And then when films pop up on the release calendar for the cinema, you know, sometimes that takes it out of consideration for the festival if we're able to give it a full theatrical run beforehand.
For sure. So a big part of this is sitting down and watching these films, whether it's you or other people on the staff. So for you personally, what's the most amount of movies you've watched back to back in order to prep for possible film festival contenders?
I mean, in the peak of programming time, as well as at Sundance, 6 films in a day is not unusual. And that includes, you know, it's not from, you know, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on a Tuesday. This is often all weekend, all hands on deck, every evening, because as many films as we watch, there's also a lot of email involved in this job. People may not realize.
What are some of the other kind of big challenges about doing this that most people aren't thinking of? You know, people might assume like, oh, what a nice job to sit and watch movies all day, but it takes more than that and to keep track of them well, right?
Yeah, I mean, sort of being attentive to the detail, being able to step outside of yourself and think about other audiences that aren't, you know, you or that maybe don't resemble you. I think a real challenge is that we may fall in love with a film and be like, this is perfect. the film distributor or the filmmaker, you know, has different plans, we hear no a lot. So as much as filmmakers get rejection, programmers also get rejection. And, it, you know, hearing, no, this doesn't, you know, your dates don't work, your film festival is not important, these kinds of things, they hurt, they sting. And you have to be able to sort of like give up, move on, fall in love with something new pretty easily.
Yeah, I want to talk about some of the heartbreaks a little more, because people might assume like, oh, you're offering a platform. Must be easy peasy, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, you know, there's different perspectives on how many film festivals say a film should play regionally before it would get a theatrical distribution deal. And those are always changing. Ideas are always changing about, you know, kind of like what the business is. And so we're sort of at the mercy of those flows a little bit. And, you know, sometimes a film will say no, and we'll go back to them a couple weeks later and be like, maybe now. And maybe they'll be like, oh, yeah, actually, our plans have kind of changed. So, you know, you're sometimes keeping an eye out for whether their decision might change, how to pitch them on something that would work for their plans, but being not too certain about any selection.
Yeah, the follow-up is important in this case, right? Because you never know what could change.
Yeah. And so, you know, sometimes you'd have a friend who is affiliated with the film, but their distributor says, no, we don't think that this festival makes sense. And that's tough.
For sure. Well, and you, of course, are thinking about Milwaukee audiences. So what boxes are you internally ticking when you're watching a film that you think our hometown would love this?
So my, you know, kind of my primary area of oversight is our documentary programming broadly. So in addition to sort of like, you know, kind of basic demographics and, you know, the kinds of audiences that we know live here and attend the festival, both of those and separately. I'm also thinking about like issues that matter, right? Things that are kind of top of mind, whether they matter locally or whether they're things that maybe we feel like we should get our heads around, even though they're not impacting us locally. So, you know, current events type of headlines, documentary films can take you kind of beyond that headline and really dig in and make topics and issues more complicated, more human, more recognizable. All of those kinds of things are ones that I keep an eye to in particular.
Well, and there's such variety in so many films that you offer over the course of the film festival that you have to keep in mind, like, maybe this group of people won't want to watch it, but there's how many of hundreds of thousands of people who might be able to see this and resonate with this film?
Yeah. I mean, we also say there's something for everyone. So it's also not oversaturating one group, right? Whether that's our members who may, you know, lean toward particular kinds of films. You know, we also want to, you know, welcome new audiences in with the offerings that we have. And, you know, with 300 films across 15 days, we think we can do it. We think there's truly something for everyone.
Well, and this year, you are welcoming the Downer screens back into your rotation. So how many doors did that open for you? Or was everything set before you even had the Downer and then you had to adjust and rework?
So timeline-wise, the Downer is a sure thing. We are fully signed, sealed, dotted line, all those T's and I's crossed and dotted as respectively, came awfully close to our final deadlines for programming, which meant that we were inviting films and we were saying, hey, we'd like to show your film, you know, however many times in the cinema, hoping that we would have enough screens for all those films. You know, we're always kind of negotiating a range so that 2 to 3, you know, now we were able to give a lot more films third screenings because we have 2 more screens. It would have been tricky. You know, we had our eye on it. It wasn't a surprise to us. We were certainly hoping that we would have those 2 screens. But, you know, for anyone who is like, oh, you've been sitting on this secret, we were not. It has happened. We have told you about as soon as it was done.
Yeah. And the film festival itself is celebrating its sweet 16 this year. So how do you personally look back, say, on your first few years of programming with the festival? And what lessons do you keep from that time? And what have you learned to just totally disregard when you first started?
I learned to disregard anything. I'm fairly reflective as a person. I come out of kind of an academic background. And so, you know, I think about my teaching career as parallel to my film programming career, which sounds wild, but I'll explain. You know, I'm always thinking, reflecting back on like what works, what's not. working. And things don't always consistently work or consistently not work. So you're sometimes trying something again, trying something anew. I definitely think that, you know, when I started programming, I did not yet know kind of the depth of curiosity that the Milwaukee audience has. I was responsible for our Rated K for Kids programming, so I was more narrow in the audience that I served at that time. And so I think over now a decade of programming, I really am very impressed by Milwaukee, right? Not that I was not expecting a lot. It's just compared to even other cities and other festival audiences, we're very lucky to have an audience that is curious and open to something maybe unexpected, you know, willing to sort of explore widely. And that's to the credit of this audience, for sure.
So on the programming side, when you're pitching to people, what's their response to a pitch from Milwaukee Film Festival as you've cemented your footing more over the years?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously as a baby festival, you know, we were new, we were unknown. I think our reputation grows as we bring more filmmakers here, as they get to meet the audiences that are here and see kind of the diversity and the depth and the curiosity and the kindness of our audiences. We have alums that want to come back. They're like, hey, I have a new film. I'm sending it to you. And please invite me to come back with my film, which is a testament to kind of the audience. We hear that we treat filmmakers well. We offer screening fees. We give them, you know, beer, but also snacks. And our cinemas are unparalleled. You know, no other film festival consistently has a venue like the Oriental Theater. No, you know, it's to see your film there is a real treat for a filmmaker.
With all that work that it takes to get us to film festival season, when we're in it, what's your favorite type of feedback that you observe from audiences or filmmakers even during the festival? What stands out?
Well, I love watching grown people walk into the lobby of the Oriental Theater for the first time, whether that's a high schooler attending an education screening or a filmmaker who's played, you know, around the world and received accolades, and watching grown people's jaws drop when they walk into that lobby is always, always a favorite because it's, you know, the response is hard to control. I like when I sort of sense that a moment in a film is going to have a reaction, whether that's a gasp or a laugh or a groan, and having that kind of happen and bearing witness to that happening across the audience. I also love when people tell me, hey, I went to see this. I didn't really know it fit my schedule. I didn't necessarily select it. And I actually really like when they're like, I don't know that I liked it, but they have something to say, right? They have something that they take away that's kind of unexpected. And back to that, you know, idea of curiosity, Milwaukee's audiences are open to that. They're open to sitting through something that they wouldn't have chosen for themselves and that they may not necessarily be having pleasure with, but that they feel compelled toward in a different way, whether that's I'm learning something or I'm thinking things or I'm, you know, I don't know if I like it because maybe I'm challenged by something. And those are the films that often then 2 years later, somebody is still thinking about. I hear them tell me, hey, I'm still thinking about this one movie that I saw. And I still don't know if I like it. That's kind of my favorite because liking something is kind of a somewhat passive response. Being constantly thinking about something and remembering it and being reminded of it, that's a much more interesting response.
Well, I'm so looking forward to the start of the Film Fest. It's my favorite time of year, and I appreciate all the work that goes into it. So, Kara, thanks for sharing a little bit more of the behind the scenes with us today.
Absolutely. We'll see you at the movies for 15 straight days.
Kara Ogburn is the artistic director of Milwaukee Film. Her work in programming the upcoming Milwaukee Film Festival is in this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and you'll find a link to that at wuwm.com. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, but ahead of that, we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at wuwm.com. Then, listen for new episodes starting in May on Thursdays during Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. Coming up, we'll explore the color purple and the benefits it gives your food. That's next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. the spring colors are finally starting to appear. Looking through Milwaukee, you'll see green grass, yellow buds, and a lot of purple. Some of our earliest blooms here in Milwaukee are crocuses and forget-me-nots. And if you head to Alice's garden, you'll see plenty of purple starting to appear. That's because it's Venus Williams' favorite color. Williams joins us every month for our series Dig In, where we explore all things gardening and healthy cooking. She joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about how you can add some purple to your garden.
This month, we're going to talk about something that I think might not sound initially plant-related, but is very related to plants and agriculture, the color purple. Why is purple so important to you?
The color purple. Anyone who knows me well knows that I love the color purple. I am not sure where that originated from, but I have loved the color purple for most of my life, beginning in my teenage years. If you come to Alice's Garden Urban Farm and you walk the labyrinth, you will notice that almost every herb in the labyrinth is the color purple. If you have ever purchased an Alice's Garden t-shirt, it is the color purple. Purple is just one of those colors that affects the mind and the body in a very uplifting way. It's a color of joy. It's a color that is calming to both the mind and the nerves. And especially for me as a minister as well, purple is associated with being a very sacred and spiritual color. But when you talk about it even as an edible plant, and we'll talk about both edibles and flowers today, the color purple in a food normally indicates something that is high in antioxidants, produces a lot of vitamins and minerals, depending upon the plant, maybe fiber. Purple fruits and vegetables are just so good for your body. And it's kind of a dull March season we're having right now. So let's bring some purple and some joy into this conversation.
There are so many different plants that come in the color purple. I think when you're someone who's starting to explore a variety of different vegetables, you'll notice that there are a lot of things that come in purple. If you like carrots, there are purple carrots. If you like cauliflower, there's purple cauliflower. What are some of the common vegetables and fruits that will come in the color purple?
Everyone knows eggplant, so we're not going to talk about eggplant, but there's so many different varieties of eggplant that come in purple. Let's talk about what you mentioned, cauliflower, and specifically purple of Sicily cauliflower. That is my favorite purple cauliflower to grow. It has beautiful, brilliant purple heads that are very sweet in flavor. Once you cook it, it becomes a bright green. Part of what I really like about this cauliflower, besides the fact that it's purple, it's also a bit easier to grow than many of the white varieties. Sometimes they can get some mold or some mildew on them, but this one does not do that. Obviously, if it's purple of Sicily, it is an Italian seed, and it comes to maturation. You know, you can eat it within 70 days of planting, and it really likes full sun. So find some purple of Sicily cauliflower seeds or starter plants and enjoy.
What are some of the other purple things that you plant in your garden that you would suggest to grow in this area?
Another one kind of in the same family as cauliflower, it's called the burgundy broccoli, but it really looks purple. And the burgundy broccoli, first of all, when people come to Alice's Garden Urban Farm and they see broccoli growing for the first time, they're just amazed at how it grows. So now let's add the color purple to it and really add to the amazement. It's really a tender, flavorful broccoli, and again, full of antioxidants. But what I really like about this broccoli as well, most broccoli are cool weather plants. So you can actually start planting broccoli in our climate in April. It doesn't like the summer heat as much, and then it comes back again strong in the fall. But this burgundy broccoli is really tolerant of a wider range of temperatures, which means that it has a longer harvest period. For those who grow broccoli, you know, you cut the first head off, the big head that comes, and then throughout the entire season, you get all of these little smaller heads of broccoli. That's part of what makes this purple broccoli so beautiful in your garden. And when I'm talking about growing these vegetables for color, I always encourage people to go ahead and mix your flowers and your veggies in your garden. You will create a beautiful masterpiece that will bring you much joy throughout the entire growing season.
What are some of your favorite purple flowers?
Ooh, my most favorite purple flowers are probably a deep purple zinnia. I don't like the very large zinnias. They tend to not do as well and last as long, but a very deep purple zinnia. And then I like cosmos. To grow the feathery cosmos in the variety of purples and pinks are quite beautiful. However, another flower that also doubles as an herb is nasturtium, and there is a purple emperor trailing nasturtium. So that means you can put it up on a trellis. And what I love about this particular nasturtium is that it has varying shades of purple. Again, for those of us who love to create a beautiful plate, to place the leaf and the flower on a salad plate, to put it into a salad. Nasturtiums give salads a very peppery kick. I also use nasturtiums to make salad dressings. So if you can imagine this beautiful salad dressing that has all of these different shades of purple in it with the flower, it just brings me joy. Okay, here we go. Joy, you're really bringing out the nerd in me today. I'm getting excited about purple flowers and purple fruit and vegetables.
Are there any other vegetables that you feel like people probably don't know actually come in purple?
Without a doubt, the Purple Majesty potato. And that's the breed. It's called Purple Majesty. Again, it's bringing in that sacredness. Purple is a royal color. So the Purple Majesty potato that is so good for you nutritionally has a very deep color, high yield. So that means that you can plant a tuber and you're going to get quite an abundance of potatoes from that. It has a delicious flavor. If you've never had a purple potato, I just really encourage you, even if you're not going to grow it, to eat it. What I really like about this potato as well, sometimes when you grow a purple vegetable and you cook it, it loses its color. That is not true with the purple potato. It has a bright violet skin, and use the skin, but the flesh remains the same even after you cook it. Another purple vegetable that a lot of people know about, but my favorite variety is the purple teepee bean. Teepee, yes, as in teepee, T-E-E-P-E-E. It again is a super productive bush bean. Now, I don't grow viney beans. That's just too much work. This particular bush bean, what I really like about it is that the bean is above the foliage. And again, if you've grown beans, you know how sometimes it's hard to harvest the beans because you have to go under the leaf and the beans tend to get heavy and hang on the ground, you know, touch the soil, and then sometimes they rot. That is not the case with the purple teepee bean. It's above there. You want to pick them young at like 4 to 5 inches. They only take 60 days to get to full growth, and they are delicious.
So as always, you have been reading. What is your book recommendation for us this month?
So I actually have two books. One is a fun, because again, we're talking purple. So one is a fun children's book, even though the title says Indigo Bloom. So the name of the children's book is Indigo Bloom, B-L-U-M-E. And The Garden City is a beautiful children's book written by Kwame Alexander and illustrated by Jossun. It starts off, its first line in the book is, Indigo Bloom skipped to the park, eating a purple plum. I'm not going to give the story away, but she ends up creating a garden with purple pots. And at the very end of this children's story, she wins a prize that is purple. You will have to buy it to find out what that is. The other book is an adult book, but it could be a children's book as well. And it's called The Cutting Garden, Growing and Arranging Garden Flowers. It's by Sarah Raven. Now, many people may know Sarah Raven. She is an incredible gardener. And even if you don't pick up The Cutting Garden as a book, if you follow her on Facebook, if you go to her website, she just makes you feel magical in the ways that she stages color and creates these beautiful gardens, both in the soil and the ground and in pots. And today we're all about beauty, feeling good, and color on this edition of Dig In.
Very nice. Well, Venus, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you for having me, and happy planting, everyone.
Venus Williams is the executive director of Alice's Garden and the Fondy Food Center. Every month, she joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about all things gardening and healthy foods in a series we call Dig In. You can find their previous conversations at WUWM.com. And Dig In wraps up today's show. Thanks for being with us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll share the results from today's spring election. Join us again tomorrow at noon for Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.